Okay, hello everybody, and we're back for another week of answering your shilas, and let's just go through it. Okay, shila number one. If one accidentally put on their left shoe before their right shoe, should they still tie their left shoe first? Meaning this is referring to the halacha, as it appears in Shulchan Aruch, that a person, generally speaking, is supposed to do the right side first. You do things on the right side first. But when it comes to tying the shoe, we tie the left shoe first. So where does that come from? It's based on the Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara in Shabbos has two different opinions about which shoe you're supposed to put on first. And the Gemara says, you know what? It's not really a machlokas because there are two things you do with shoes. You put them on and you also tie them. So the opinion that says right comes first is talking about putting on the shoes. The opinion that says left comes first is talking about tying the shoes. And I think Tosfos points out that the idea of tying the left shoe first relates to the fact that it's that we tie the tefillin on our left hand, so the tying of the left before the right is because tying somehow is reminiscent of the tefillin. So we see that tying goes on the left. So based on that, I would think that regardless of whether you did the right order or the wrong order in putting on the shoes, I would think that you would still tie the left one first because the whole idea is somehow a connection to tefillin. It's probably explicit in Poskim somewhere, but I did not have a chance to look around. But anyway, that's what I would think, just off the bat. Okay, question number two. I am a paying Talmud in a yeshiva in Israel, and the fridge of the yeshiva Chadar Ochel is kept locked at all times. Is there any halachic issue with entering the fridge and taking food if that food is already designated for the Bachrim of the yeshiva? I assume by entering the fridge, a person means breaking into the fridge, that going into the fridge when they are not invited to do so, when they are not encouraged to do so. So I think that this is a serious problem. I think when you go to a school, you are agreeing to the rules of that school. You don't have to sign up for that school. You could pay your tuition dollars somewhere else and go to a different school. Yes, you are paying for the agreement that they're going to nourish you and house you if that's the agreement, meaning some schools don't have that agreement. In seminaries, they have dorms, but they often do not provide meals. In Yeshiva University, for example, there are guys that live in apartments and they don't sign up. It's a separate fee to pay for the dormitory and for the meals. When you sign up to a particular place, to be in a particular place, you're signing up to their rules. So, for example, even though I am not allowed to confiscate anything that belongs to you and destroy it, because that's adam hamazik, and I would be chayv to pay for that. If a school has a rule that any smartphone that's seen on campus is going to immediately be destroyed, remember Yeshiva Darchei Torah, I think maybe they still have it. They have a giant fish tank. I don't think there are any fish in the fish tank. They're just cell phones in the fish tank. Their rule is that if you have a phone in school, they drop it in the fish tank, and that's okay because you sign up knowing that that's the rule, and therefore you are committing yourself to that. So a yeshiva has to nourish you within reason. They have to provide the room and board. They don't have to have a tea room that's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if they don't want people coming in, it's a very reasonable thing to not want Bachram coming into the kitchen and just taking things at will whenever they want. They need to plan out the meals to make sure that they have the right amount of food at the right times for the Bachram and the yeshiva. So yeah, I think it's a real problem. Shaila number three. I heard recently that there's a mitzvah to charge non-Jews ribbis. Is there a makor for this? And if so, what would be the reason? Yeah, there's definitely a makor for this. The Rambam includes it in Sefer HaMitzvos. The pasuk says, "Lanochri tashich," and the Rambam understands that that's a mitzvah saseh to charge a nochri ribbis. The pashpshan and pasuk, one might argue, is that it's a heter, not a mitzvah. That even though there's an isser, multiple isurim actually, to charge ribbis to a Jewish person, but to charge ribbis to a non-Jewish person, don't worry, you're allowed to do that, right? That's the pasuk, pshat and pasuk. But the Rambam understands that it's an actual mitzvah saseh to do so. I think the Ramban disagrees. Now, why would there be such a mitzvah? So the basis, I think, is as follows. Generally speaking, Rav Schachter often points out that mitzvos ben adam l'chaveru work with the notion of reciprocity, that there's an understanding that I am supposed to treat others as I would hope they would treat me. Now, when it comes to your own family, you certainly have a heightened expectation of the way they would treat you, more so than a total stranger. The Jewish people happen to be one very big family, and therefore we do crazy things for each other, like giving massive amounts of money to people we never met. When we give 10% or 20% of our income to people we've never met, we give kidneys to each other, because those are the kinds of things that you would do for a brother, and we view ourselves as brothers and sisters. When it comes to other people, we wouldn't expect them to do those kinds of things for us, but we would expect them to not steal from us, to treat us with a certain amount of decency and respect, and that's what we're supposed to do for others as well. So when it comes to charging interest, the way of the world is nobody lends money for free, except unless you're lending money to a family member. If you're tying up my money, that means that I'm not able to make money with that money. I'm not able to invest it. I'm not able to start a business, because you're borrowing my money and you have it for a year or for however long the term of the loan is. So it is not the way of the world to lend money without charging interest. It is normal, it is healthy, it is regular to charge interest unless you're dealing with family. And the Jewish people are family. So I think that would be the explanation. As a matter of halacha, it's just important to note that in Bav Metzia, the Mishnah says that you're allowed to lend to and borrow from a non-Jew with ribbis. But the Gemara says, even though lending to a non-Jew with ribbis is allowed midaraisa, Chazal only allowed doing so in two cases. If, first of all, if a Jew needs the support of the, needs the money to support his family, like he needs that for basic necessities, or if he's a Talmud Chacham and he's not going to learn from the ways of the non-Jews by charging with ribbis. But in any other case, lending to a non-Jew with ribbis is asur midrabanan, because we assume it's going to create too much of a connection and you'll end up learning a lot of other behaviors, from the business behaviors and otherwise, from the non-Jew. The tour and many other Rishonim paskin that today, you don't have to hesitate at all, and you're allowed to lend money to a non-Jew with ribbis, because it would be very difficult to earn money if we didn't. So in Shulchan Aruch, we paskin the Chosh Mishpat, in Yoredei rather, Shulchan Aruch paskins that lending with ribbis to a non-Jew is mutter mida oraisa. And the Taz says that the mitzvah of lending without ribbis applies only to lending to a Jew. But non-Jews are not included in the mitzvah. And then the Shulchan Aruch says, and Chazal say, that you're not allowed to lend to a non-Jew with ribbis unless you need the money for your basic necessities or your Talmud Chacham. But again, nowadays the minhag is not that way. Nowadays the minhag is that we do lend to a non-Jew. So even though the Gemara pulled it back a little bit, the Rambam says it's a mitzvah min haTorah, but the Gemara says you're not really supposed to do it. We do it. Whether we hold that we're doing a mitzvah, I'm not sure. But I think the idea would be, again, that you're not supposed to treat a non-Jew like he is your brother. You're supposed to treat him with decency and with respect and with kindness, but not like he's your brother. And that's why Meshav Aveda to non-Jew, there are certain things that we shy away from, because you're not, if you fail to distinguish between Jewish people and non-Jewish people, that is not a good thing. Question number four, is there anything usur or inappropriate with going on one knee to propose? So the issue would be, is this a question or is this a violation of Chukas HaGayim? Now, there are different shitos in Rishonim and Achronim. What would qualify as Chukas HaGayim? The Smag in Los HaSei Nun says that anything that's miyuchad lahem, that's miyuchad for the Gayim, should be also for us. The Gra says, not anything that involves, practices of worship, like having trees in a shul or something like that. The Maharik writes that any act of pritzus, or anything that has no logical explanation, is going to be aser. Beis Yosef explains why if it has no logical explanation, because if there's no logical explanation for why people do it, then you always have to be choshesh that maybe it comes from avodah zarah. That's what the Rama writes in Kofayin Ches, that if there's no tam, you have to be concerned that maybe it comes from a shemetz of avodah zarah, that there's some remnant of avodah zarah in this action. So take, for example, having birthday candles. According to the Smag and the Grud, it's a problem. it probably was based in some level of worship. And maybe according to the Ma'arik, it's a problem. Maybe it's based in Avodah Zarah, according. Now, what about getting down on one knee? So it's miyuchad. It could be a problem according to the Smag, maybe for the Gra, maybe for the Ma'arik, because we don't know exactly how it came to be that people get down on one knee. Although one could argue, what do you mean? It's not. This getting down on one knee is not something that has no time. It's a show of submission, that there are certain postures that a person takes that that reflect certain emotions and certain feelings. So getting down on your knees is a show of submission. Getting down on one knee, I guess, is a partial show of submission. And you're saying that I'm now going to submit myself to you for the rest of my life. So one could make that argument. I once asked the Shaila to Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Willig was very unhappy about it, that weddings used to be that, at the end of the second dance or whatever, the chassan would sing Eshes Chayil to the Kala. That used to be the minhag. So you don't see it so much anymore at weddings. So very often the chassan would get down on one knee and sing Eshes Chayil to the Kala back in my day when people were getting married 25 years ago. That's what they would do. Rabbi Willig would see that. He'd run over to the chassan and pick him up. He would lift him up off the ground. That's not a Jewish thing, getting down on one knee. I asked Rav Yonasan Sachs. He said that it's a stamashtus. It's probably, definition of chukas akum according to the Rambam. So I always tell the Talmidim they should not do that. They should not do that. I mean, you can ask a girl to marry you without getting down on one knee. Number five, if lamdus and or iyun is the deeper understanding, why do we seem to paskin more like pshat and not like the lamdus or the iyun? So I don't mean to be harsh over here, but if you can't paskin based on your lamdus, then your lamdus is probably wrong. Meaning the lamdus is not just an exercise in showing off your intelligence. That's a lamdus shel hevel. Lamdus is an exercise in understanding the depth of the truth of the matter. And halacha is based on coming to the truest understanding of the underpinnings of the halacha. There is a very, very deep connection between lamdus and psak. A posek who has no lamdus has no psak, and a lamdin who has no halacha is not a lamdin. Meaning, there's a wonderful article that was written by Rabbi Bleich Shlita in Contemporary Halachic Problems, I think it's volume 4 or volume 5, called Halacha and Lamdus, or something like that. Lamdus and psak, it's called something like that. And he explains the connection between lamdus and psak. If you look, for example, at Moreno Agon Rav Shechter Shlita, he is a lamdan par excellence. It's one of the things that frustrates me to no end when people say, oh, Rav Shechter, he's like an AI, he's like Google, he's like, as if, he's an encyclopedia, as if that's his godless, that he happens to remember Kol HaTorah Kula. That is a small part of his godless. His godless is that he's a lamdan who has the underpinnings of every halacha and the understanding of all of Shas and what the klalim are that everything is based on, and he paskins based on his lamdus. He paskins based on his lamdus. You look in Eretz HaTzvi, and he has the distinction between a gzeira d'rabbanan and a malacha d'rabbanan, and he paskins like that. He paskins that a gzeira d'rabbanan is mutter for kol hashem bal sakana, but not a malacha d'rabbanan. A lot of other poskim will say, anytime there's a d'rabbanan, it's always mutter for kol hashem bal sakana. No, Rav Shechter points out that there's a distinction. You go through the sugyas, and you understand the lumdus of that distinction, then you understand that there is a difference between it. I'll give you another example I just came across last night. Why does the Mishnah say that when Rabbi Tarfon tried to follow the Beis Shammai by lying down for Kriya Shema, he was Meschayev Benafsha? We say, no, you can't follow the Beis Shammai. But the Gemara says that somebody who goes back to where he ate in order to bench in accordance with the Shita of Beis Shammai, and he went back a great distance, he's deserving of finding a Kishel Zahav. So why is that? Why? Which is it? Are you not supposed to follow the Shita of Beis Shammai? Or do we say that it's a great thing to follow the Shita of the Beis Shammai? So different Rishonim and Achronim give answers. Rav Shechter quotes from Rav Soloveitchik. One answer that the Rishonim give is that even the Beis Hillel agree it's a laudable thing to go back to where you ate to bench. So that is something that you can do. But Beis Hillel does not think it's a laudable thing to lie down to say Kriya Shema Shel Arvis. Others suggest that you know, when it's something that comes up all the time, so then you run the risk of having the Torah appear kishtei toros. But if it's something that comes up very rarely, so you don't run that risk, and therefore you could follow the sheet of the Beis Shammai, and it doesn't risk splitting Klal Yisrael into two. So going back to where you ate a meal when you forgot to manage, that's a rare circumstance. Kriyat Shema is an everyday circumstance, but Rav Soloveitchik said that no, lying down for Kriyat Shema is specifically against Beis Hillel's drasha, because Beis Hillel held Ubelechtecha v'derech means that you're kederech, that you're supposed to say Kriyat Shema in whatever manner you find yourself, that you're not supposed to specifically be makbid on a particular posture in Kriyat Shema. And therefore, when one is following the Beis Shammai, they're not just being machmir like the Beis Shammai, they're being machmir against the Beis Hillel. And that you're not allowed to do. So says Rav Shechter, what is this about not standing, yes standing, not lying, yes lying? He said, normally, when you have something that is a davar shebekdusha, the klal is that for a davar shebekdusha, a person has to stand. The klal is for a davar shebekdusha, a person should have an atifas harosh. They should have some wrapping on their head, some hat on their head or something, or a talis wrapped around their head. What this halacha is teaching us, what Beis Hillel is teaching us, is that even though Kriyat Shema is said in the context of Baruch Hu and followed by Shemona Esrei, and it's surrounded by Dvar Mishav Kedusha, and there's a Kedusha that's said in the Birchus Kriyat Shema, the Kadosh, 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 and all of that, even though it has all of that, the fact that you do not have to stand for Kriyat Shema tells me that we don't follow the rules of Dvar Mishav Kedusha. And therefore, you also don't have to do Atifas Harosh for Kriyat Shema, for Birchus Kriyat Shema and Kriyat Shema. And he said that's why Reb Chaim would not have his talus over his head during Birchus Kriyat Shema, because the same Yesod Hadin that would require standing is the same Yesod that would require Atifa. That is it's a Davar Shebekdusha. But we don't follow the rules of Davar Shebekdusha when it comes to standing, and therefore we're not going to follow the rules of Davar Shebekdusha when it comes to Atifas Harosh either. It's halacha based on understanding the lumdus of the case. Okay, question number 6. On the new parking meters in the five towns, before you pay, it says, if you don't remove your car in 5 minutes, then something along the lines of you'll get a ticket. If I'm running into a store for less than 5 minutes, do I have to pay the meter? I think it seems built into the system that it's mutter, you know, that there's no law that you must pay a meter. The law is that you have to follow Dina de Malchusa. And I think in general, when it comes to Dina de Malchusa, a law that is enforced is a Dina de Malchusa, and a law that there's no interest in enforcing, or that they specifically do not enforce, or may not even be a law, is that you get 5 minutes free, is not covered by Dina de Malchusa. We once even asked Rav Willig years ago if it's mutter to hire a housekeeper and pay her off the books, you know, to pay a housekeeper in cash as opposed to filing social security taxes and everything else, which would cost you at least twice as much money. And she would have to be a legal worker and things like that. So Rabbi Willig said, if the government dafka looks the other way and they don't really want to know about these things, they don't really care, and they have nothing else to do with all these illegal immigrants, and they'd rather have them be employed in these types of jobs, then it would not be a violation of Dina de Malchusa. Maybe now it's different. Maybe with President Trump and ICE, running around trying to arrest everyone here in the Heights, it's like a big deal. The ICE agents are all over the place. The guys were joking that if it's difficult to find an apartment in the Heights for young couples when they get married, and they'd like to live near yeshiva, obviously. So the guys were joking that you see an ICE agent, if you see an apartment that you like, just tell the ICE agents, go there, and they'll chuck the people out to a different country. Okay, not such a funny joke, but maybe they are taking it more seriously, and they are really enforcing a lot of these laws. So maybe it's going to be different. I don't know. But I think as far as the parking meter, it's fine. Number 7. If I print out notes from Shir to Chazar on Shabbos, do they need to go into Shemus? So there is a famous tshuva of the Netziv, where the Netziv says that anytime you print out something with the intention of only using it temporarily, in the Tziv holds, even if it has actual Shem Hashem in it and full Psukim and everything else, it doesn't have Kedusha. That you get to control the Kedusha of the item by intending not to give it Kedusha. So if you print it out just to use it temporarily, not to give it Kedusha, so you have the ability to withhold the Kedusha from it. So generally speaking, I think people do not rely on that Netziv when we're dealing with actual Shemos of Hashem and actual full Pesukim. But notes from Ashir, I think people do rely on that Netziv. You should dispose of it in a respectful way, not, you know, it shouldn't be with the chicken bones from last night's dinner with dirty diapers or whatever, but you put it in a separate bag or something before you throw it out. But I think the minhag is to be makel on those things. What do they do with the parsha sheets in shul, right? People don't like bring them home and collect them and have, I don't think, I've never in my life seen someone read any of those parsha sheets outside of shul. So most of them are left there in shul, and I don't think they save them. I don't think they typically all go into Seamus. So it's the same thing. Number 8, may one fulfill Shalach Manos and Matanos of Yonim through their parents. So I think that the halacha is that every single person over bar bas mitzvah is obligated to Shalach Manos and Matanos of Yonim. So I think you cannot fulfill it through your parents, in the sense that just because your parent is doing the mitzvah, I don't think that mitzvah counts for you. Your parent, eats 3 meals on Shabbos. I don't think you can just say, okay, so I won't eat because they're doing the mitzvah. I think you have to do the mitzvah yourself. You can make a shaliach to give shalach manos for you. You can make a shaliach to give matanos levyonim for you. So that's probably a worthwhile thing to do, to make a parent a shaliach. Number 9, the Ramah says that men and women should avoid giving each other mishalach manos so as not to get into a suffik kiddushin. Does this mean that couples who are dating engaged over Purim should avoid giving each other mishalach manos? And if so, why do dating couples often give each other small gifts throughout the dating process? Should we be assuming that there's a suffik kiddushin there as well? So yeah, there is a Ramah that actually says this. Ramah writes, Isha chayeves b'matanos evyon mishalach manos ki'ish, v'isha tishlach li'isha v'ish li'ish avalo behepech, shlo yavu ish l'shlach la'almana v'yavo l'idei suffik kiddushin. That if the matan zevyonim, we're not so worried about it, but for mishloach manos, we try to keep it within the same gender. Happens to be prichadash holds women are pater from mishloach manos because it says ish l'rei ehu. But most poskim assume that women are chayiv in mishloach manos. So again, the Ramah thinks that there is an actual concern of safek kiddushin. It's somewhat problematic because the Ramah in Ebenezer Simon Memhei is explicit that if you give the gift clearly for another reason, or if you say explicitly that it's a Doron B'Alma, that it's just a gift, then you don't have to be Choshesh for Kiddushin, which really answers the second part of the person's question. How can engaged couples ever give each other gifts? Because they make it clear that it's just a gift, and the Ramah's Beferish. So the Mishnah Berurah explains that people are going to be Choshesh, that the gifts that you're giving are the sivlonos that follow the Kiddushin, and they're not going to think this is the Kiddushin, but that there previously had been a Kiddushin, which would seem that for an engaged couple, it's an even bigger concern, because people might think that they just took the next step, so it's interesting. Whatever the reason, you're gonna have to explain why it's not a concern for Matanos Levyonin, right? So Lemaisa, I think I asked Rabbi Sablovsky about this once, and he said, even though there's not much to be choshish for, since we no longer do sivlonos and gifts are regularly given for birthdays and other occasions, so it isn't an especially great concern of Kiruv Hadas, but since it's an explicit Ramah, we should observe the Ramah. So engaged couples should not give each other mishloach manos one to the other. But the minhag is we definitely give gifts to the other, because the Ramah Nebuchadnezzar is explicit that you're allowed to, and the whole concern of sivlonos afterwards is not really a concern nowadays. Rabbi Sablovsky said, if you want a workaround, give it to the family. So, a young man who's engaged can give his kallah's family mishloach manos. Shmuel Kamenetsky writes that the real reason is what the Aruch HaShulchan said, that there's going to be too much kiruv das. and therefore it's not so relevant nowadays. We're also not choshesh l'savonos nowadays, so to avoid suffolk yedushin, just don't give it in front of two edim. That's how Shmuel Kamenetsky writes. And a final question: how do we define what is fit to be on the table of a king for the purposes of bishul akum? So this is a reference to the halacha that anything that's ola al shulchan malachim is subject to bishul akum, a type of food that is a dignified enough food that a king would eat, that is considered to be subject to bishul akum. But if it's not a dignified enough food for a king to eat, then it would not be subject to bishul akum. So how do we define that? I think this was the old question about sardines in Europe. Some said that the canned sardines were cooked, and they were cooked by non-Jews in the factories, and people ate it all the time. So some tainted, well, wait a second, do you think the Queen of England doesn't have sardines for breakfast? Meaning it may not be served at a state dinner, but it's something that she would eat. She would eat for breakfast. I could tell you, Man Malki Rabbanan, the greatest malachim are the big Talmid Chachamim. I was just in the Rebbe's room here in Yeshiva 5 minutes before I started recording this, and Rav Shechter was sitting there eating sardines. So there are certain people, I think it's his way of getting people to, to leave him alone for a few minutes, because no one wants to go anywhere near sardines. So he eats sardines when he takes his late afternoon snack. I don't know. But that's the old question. So I think the minig is that we are makel, that we assume that it's something that would be served at a state dinner or something that would be served at a chasana. And one has to be sort of... I don't know, you call it on guard or noticing the trends. When I was younger, mashed potatoes would never be served at a wedding. Nowadays, almost every wedding I go to, there's mashed potatoes underneath the chicken or the meat or whatever. They're delicious, but so are mashed potatoes, alal shulchan malachim. They used to not be, now they probably are. There's a big discussion about potato chips, right? Because that's another question. What if this form of preparing the food would not be served at a state dinner, but the very same ingredients prepared differently would be? So potatoes, yes. Potato chips, maybe not, right? So that's a big discussion. I think the OU is makil on potato chips. This is a major discussion. But I think generally speaking, we say whatever would not be served at a chasana would not be subject to bishul akum. Okay, everyone should have a freilich and purim, a wonderful week, and we'll be back next week, be'ezras Hashem b'li neder, with more questions.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. A lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.